I'm Levy Dalton.
And I'm Erin Scala.
And this is I'll Drink to That, a weekly behind-the-scenes look at the wine business.
Are you guys ready to get warmed up? Because I am.
The relationship between oak and wine runs deeper than we may think it does on the surface. Sure, many wines are fermented or aged in several species of oak, but oak is also used to transport wine in ships, and corks come from a particular species of oak tree. I think it's interesting how the wine world has such a direct tie to so many different species of oak. The tree genus Quercus, or oak, has over 600 species. Cork is made from the bark of the Quercus suber tree, and corks are a renewable product. Quercus suber trees can live up to 300 years, and the bark regrows every 10 years. A little more than a century ago, you may have gone to any European dock and found a boat made from Quercus suber, or cork oak. Not the bark here, but the hardwood trunk under the bark. This was used in ships because it was resistant to rot. And this hypothetical ship may have been packed with barrels of Quercus robur, French oak, Quercus patria, Russian oak, all filled with wine, and the barrels may have been stopped with corks made from the Quercus suber bark. Due to this complex interrelationship between Quercus forestry and beverage production, entire businesses have evolved around these trees. Cooperage is a centuries-old craft and the most obvious industry that evolved with wine production. Cork production is another industry that has been made possible by this species. Cork extraction machines emerged over the last several centuries to remove such corks, and in fact, in the mid-1800s, several beer and wine producers used corkscrews as business cards. And the success of a few companies has been in part to their marketing on the handles of corkscrews. More recently, oak has influenced our industry as companies have started to sell and manufacture oak chips, oak-derived additives, and oak-like extract substitutes to add to wine to create the illusion of oak aging. I wonder, how different would the classic format of wine, and by classic format I'm referring to the glass bottle plus cork combo, so glass bottle and corks. How different would this format be if Quercus genus and its multitude of oak species had evolved differently? If we had never had oak, we would never have corks. And would we ever have had a glass bottle format? And if the glass bottle format had evolved differently, would the idea of a crown cap or stelve enclosure even have been thought up? In the last decade or so, the backlash of heavy oak use in wines has been pretty extensive and global. And I hear a lot of sommeliers and winemakers talk about how, oh, this is over-oaked or that's over-oaked. But the next time you pull a cork or drink wine that was shipped in from overseas on a boat that most likely had some oak structure to it, pause for a moment and consider the pervasive value that this tree genus has had throughout the wine industry. It's driven our standard format, which for all its strengths and weaknesses has revolutionized the wine industry over the last couple centuries.
Folks, I'm happy to report that the Riesling Fia will soon be returning to New York from February 20th through February 22nd. This is the second time around that Steven Bitterhoff has organized an amazing celebration of German Riesling. And let me tell you, last year was freaking sensational. Awesome. Well done and a lot of fun. This year, the main event, the big dinner, is already sold out. But you can email info@rieslingfier.com to get on the waiting list, which is pretty much the only way to buy tickets anymore, or to find out about the special Riesling Fier seminars and smaller dinners that will also be coming up. I highly recommend contacting Steven. It's info@rieslingfier, so I-N-F-O, at Riesling, F-E-I-E-R, rieslingfier.com. Send him an email, find out the details, and keep an eye out for the upcoming Riesling Crawl on February 22nd. Which will feature several top New York German-centric retailers for some really fabulous tastings. Get there, drink Riesling, experience the Riesling Fear. You won't be disappointed. Delish.
Hey, this is Michael Madrigal from Barbalude and Balude Sued. In case you haven't heard of 750, you should know about it. It's a tool for wine buyers, for wine directors, for sommeliers, to find wines, to find the prices, to find the distributors, to do all of those things that you need to do in your daily job. to do work on your wine list, and I am a big fan of it. And if you don't know it, you should do your homework and find out.
The big news for the podcast in 2014, retail partnership, my friend. The wines we care about from the folks who are on the show, offered to you by the excellent team at Vine Wine. Go to vine-wine.com for more information about what we're up to and to find the wines. That's vine-wine.com. Check it out. Cheers. Stephen Henschke on the show today. Hello, sir. How are you?
Thank you. Living very well.
Very nice to have you here.
Thank you very much.
So you're the fifth generation winemaker at Henschke.
That's correct.
And you have Silesian roots. Am I saying that right? Silesian?
Silesian, yeah.
And what does that mean?
That means that the German Lutheran families that settled in the Barossa in South Australia came from a part of Germany, which is now where Poland is, the western side of Poland, near the River Oder. So Frankfurt under Oder is there, Grünberg, in that sort of area. And they came out to Australia because of religious persecution under the King Friedrich Wilhelm III. But they did have winemaking. Some of them did have winemaking background there. So there was viticulture and winemaking in that part of Europe, even though it's that far east and north. So there are lots of jokes about the Silesian Rieslings burning holes in tables and things like that. But I'm sure it's not true.
Well, it's interesting because I know both your father and yourself at one point went back to Germany to study, your wife as well, and it felt like kind of completing a circle almost when you said that your dad in 1970 was awarded a fellowship to travel through Europe, including Germany.
Correct. Absolutely.
And how did that come about, and what were you doing at that time?
I was at university. He applied for this Churchill Fellowship, which is a very Australian thing, which was a scholarship to study further for people who hadn't had a tertiary education. And he was the first winemaker to apply and won the scholarship. Travelled extensively in 1970 around through America and Europe and South Africa, and came up back to Australia and wrote up his report. The really fascinating part was that he made connection with two, so what I call luminaries in the industry at the time, Professor Bruno Goetz from Freiburg Wine Institute and Professor Dr. Helmut Becker from Geisenheim in Germany. And Becker was a famous geneticist. He was the head of the Geisenheim Wine School. And so he'd spent time with him. And Becker, sort of ironically almost, the opportunity came up in Australia with the CSIRO to look at breeding Australian grape varieties. And one of those, and Becker was asked to be involved because of his genetic background. He's also a very funny guy used to love swearing in Australian, you know, bloody this and bloody that. so he came out to Australia. And because he had known my father, he wanted to come and visit, loved my father's wines and all that sort of thing. And one day when I was home from university for dinner, and Becker was there and we were talking, and he asked me what I was going to do. And at that time, I was thinking about going to Roseworthy College, which is Australian wine school. And he said to me, no, come and study with me in Germany. And so that gave me the opportunity of going to Geisenheim. And because, you know, there are a couple of things that come into play, but because Prue and I became good friends at university and you know, we were planning to get married sometime anyway, it made more sense to get married before we went to Germany because of the difficulties of renting flats. You know, this is back in the 70s, you have to remember. When you're not married, so it made sense to get married. So I said, well, why don't we get married and go to Germany and study over there? All I needed was my father's financial help, blessing, and off we went. And we had, you know, just over 2 years in Germany, had a great time studying winemaking, viticulture. Prue worked with Becker in the institute. He was a vine breeding, vine grafting specialist, vine propagation. So she learned all those sorts of techniques, which drove her background was in botany, So it drove her into, you know, into more the botanical side of viticulture, and it was a fantastic grounding for her because of the Germans were all about, you know, improving the breed and all that sort of thing. So it gave her...
When it comes to vines.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I just want to make sure what we're talking about here for, you know, I get in trouble.
Sure.
But so she's there, and she also studied with Dr. Richard Smart at some point.
She actually came back when after we came back in late 77, she got a job at Roseworthy College as a technical research officer. So she was actually working with Dr. Richard Smart, Peter Dry, Patrick Ireland, all those sorts of guys. And it was a really interesting time in Australia at that time because there was a lot of work being done on site selection, which in Australia meant instead of just planting where you've inherited your land or whatever, you actually look at the topography, the climate across Australia. If you want to plant cool climate varieties like Chardonnay, Pinot Noir and Sauvignon Blanc or whatever, then you go looking for suitable, you know, climates and soils. And so it was really a new thinking at that time in Australia. And that was great for us. That's quite stimulating. But the other side was also canopy management. And we'd studied in Germany, so we, you know, we're full bottle on this. But the level of exposure you need with the canopy relates to the vigour of the vine, effectively. And Dr. Richard Smart, Dick Smart, wrote a book which was called Sunlight into Wine, and it sort of describes all that sort of process. So Prue was working with him at the time, and it was really good stuff. And because we had a lot of ideas that we picked up in Germany in those couple of years and also extensively travelling around Europe, we wanted to road test them really, preferably not in the old museum vineyards of Hilly Gross Mount Edelson, because we didn't want to muck them up at all. We wanted to sort of make sure that we had the right ideas and plans to improve those vineyards. And so we ended up finding a suitable orchard, actually, as it turned out, up in the Adelaide Hills, which satisfied a couple of criteria because it was colder, wetter part of South Australia, which is ideal for apples and cherries and pears and things, but also ideal for cool climate grape varieties. So we bought that orchard, for better or for worse. Prue became an apple grower, and you know, my joke is she was, you know, selling Granny Smith apples to the school kids in Adelaide. But it was, you know, it was an interesting time because in apples production they use a lot of sprays, a lot of insecticides, a lot of herbicides and all that sort of thing, and that, you know, that put on a red light for us. And then when fortuitously, as it may be, a huge wildfire came out of the forest, the Mount Crawford forest alongside of us in 1983. So these were the bushfires of South Australia back in 83, and it destroyed our vineyard and a couple other people's orchards and vineyards alongside of us, or our potential vineyard, I should say, because we did have some rows of Chardonnay that we'd planted in a spare block, and they survived. So it was a good omen. And we then pulled out the dead trees and started, you know, made a farm plan and started planting up with Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, Riesling, Merlot and things like that. And that really gave us a chance because it's quite steep in the Adelaide Hills, quite steep country, up to 30% slopes. So it gave us a chance to test not only canopy management, but soil management techniques and things like that. And they're the ideas then that we tested there that we were able to slowly take back into the other Henschke Eden Valley vineyards. Also those more organic ideas that we'd come up with. Because I think it seems to be a thing when you start having children that you start to think about what you put in your mouth. When you're at university, it's not quite so important, but when you get a bit older, it is. And so just the thought of spraying, you know, these sorts of insecticides and herbicides in our vineyard and then eating the grapes wasn't something that, you know, just rang alarm bells for us. Wasn't something we wanted to do. So we, before organic was popular, we started working towards an organic regime in our vineyards. But also the other area was from Yeah, when we came back, we knew Europe well. We, you know, we knew the soils of Europe, all the varieties and things, but we didn't really understand our soils properly. And we wanted to get a better hold of what our soils were all about, you know, why these vines had lasted so long, dry growing iron root type vines.
Because you had vines that dated back to the 1860s.
Absolutely. And so there were a couple of things that helped us. One was some work that a guy called Keith Northcott had done at CSIRO in Adelaide. And it was he had mapped the Mount Lofty ranges, and all the soils, the climate, the rainfalls, temperatures and things. And that was really useful. We are in the Hutton Vale Soil Association, it's called. And there are effectively, if you look at the geology of South Australia, this was all, we're on a big tectonic plate. So Australia is a tectonic plate moving north from Gondwana land, from Antarctica. And there's a lot of erosion off the tectonic plate over millions and millions of years. And those seabed silts basically built up and sort of formed the bottom edge of the southern part of Australia. And then at some stage, something like 500 million years ago, there was some almighty collision that formed this mountain range called the Mount Lofty Ranges. And so it's really seabeds pushed up into like a book. And as they weather down, you can read the silts, the different ages of the silts, up to, you know, more or less modern day, which was the sea creatures on the top of the seabed that formed a limestone face right along the edge of the ranges. That's the background of the soil. So the soils are weathered silts and sea and metamorphosed silts and sandstones. And they're quite low in organic matter. They have some natural salinity built into them. And I guess the key was when we realised that these were potentially sodic soils, low in organic matter, that we had to do something about that. And that organic sort of thinking helped along that process. So these days, carbon is a bad word, seems to be a bad word, but really carbon's the most important element on the planet in terms of life. So in your vineyard, it's incredibly important to have higher organic carbon, which is humus and mulch, to keep the vines healthy and keep the soil healthy. And so that was our process of looking at things to put in the vineyard to help balance the vineyard, rather than the sort of modern way of just putting fertilizers on the ground, which tend to poison the soil more than anything else, or acidify the soil at least. So that was a process, the direction we went. And through up to about 7 years ago, then Pro got more into the biodynamic side of it. And from in the process of biodynamics, it was really, for her, it was about making good quality compost to put in the vineyard and using all of our waste products. So by incorporating with our waste stream of skins and seeds from the winery, but also incorporating in straw mulch, green waste, some lime, cow manure, into big biscuits with a, you know, maybe...
Not the kind you eat, but...
It's a couple hundred ton of grape mark, you know, sort of building into these huge biscuits. They're composted down. But by learning about the biodynamics, that she found that by putting these preps, like the 500 preps, into the compost heap, it gave a much better compost. And you could just see the fungi growing through the compost and just forming this really amazing quality compost. You know, she measured the temperatures. She, you know, was like a doctor following all this sort of stuff. And then we put that out in the vineyard. And so that process is important because instead of using the common practice in Australia was to what I call a dead earth policy. It was to spray out the grass under the rows of vines, occasionally plant things in the row, but always rotary hoe them in so they kill them off so it was bare during the summer. And the way we were working was to use a straw mulch under the vines, which basically then is like a blanket. So it keeps the vines cooler, the vine roots cooler in the hot summer, but also allows microbes and worms and things to live under that and retains better soil moisture. But there is a bit of what's called nitrogen drawdown because of the straw starts to break down. So it's using the nitrogen to help that. So by putting organic compost underneath or biodynamic compost stuff underneath, you overcome that and you help, you know, just very gently feed the vines with some nutrient as well. Then in the rows between, instead of working them up and smashing up the soil, because Australian soils are incredibly sensitive and delicate, being so ancient, we worked on a so she, as a as a botanist, she went looking for native grasses that would fulfill that trick, fill that job, and they're all along the roadside still growing there. So she collected seeds and started building this up, got other people interested in native grasses and formed a native grasses resource group. And one guy in the Adelaide Hills was just incredibly clever in inventing things. So he invented a way of seeding these grasses, because these grasses are very fluffy. They're not like wheat grains. They're really light and fluffy. And so they won't go through a normal combine. You actually have to pelletize them first to run them through. So he just came up with all those clever ways of harvesting, of seeding. And we've got these most beautiful native grasses in our vineyard. But there's something else that comes in that we weren't expecting, and that's it also brings insects back in, which predate on the grubs, the caterpillars that eat the grapevines. So it gave us a double benefit. And she got involved then in a project with the CSIRO in looking at native flowering plants that provide the perfect nectar source for these insects. So we would actually get a more complex ecosystem within the vineyard of these native plants and the native grasses for these insects to keep them happy and give them a home, and they can parasitize the light brown apple moth and the vine moth and what have you, and control those insect pests that we've got. So our sort of our long-term plan is effectively that the only thing left in the vineyard that's a weed is a vine. Everything else is native. So it sort of becomes a bit ironical at the end.
So let's take it from what you said and circle back a little bit. You have vineyards in the Eden Valley, which at some points is very high in elevation.
Yep.
And you have now vineyards in the Adelaide, which was cool climate, and also there was a lot of problems with fungal issues, and people had to spray a lot.
That's right.
And so there were vines there, and then they kind of gave up, and then Petaluma came in, then you sort of followed.
That's right.
And I would think that experience in Germany probably really helped you understand both of those issues, as well as what kind of soils exactly do we have, which is something they think about all the time.
That's right.
And then working with Dr. Richard Smart probably set some of the groundwork for trying to get more emphasis on canopy management, which seems to be very big for Prue, who's the viticulturist with the winery today, where you do the winemaking, and putting vertical shoot positioning. So what is vertical shoot positioning, and how does it help in different areas that you use it? Because you don't use it all the time.
No, that's a really good question. I guess the connection there is that red wine varieties particularly need some exposure to light. With white varieties like Riesling, you really want dappled light. So you actually want a fluffy canopy that covers up the grapes a bit and doesn't allow them to get sunburned. But with red grapes, they're actually more hardy. Curiously, and I can only think that our ancestors were very, very far-sighted, very clever in terms of the way they planted vineyards, because most of the vineyards were planted east-west, which means in the height of summer when the sun's directly overhead, instead of burning the grapes, if they were planted north-south, you'd get smashed with the hot afternoon sun. Because it goes overhead, you don't get that same sort of sun damage, sunburn. Effectively then, by lifting the canopy up more and lifting the canopy down, as in the Scott Henry trellis, you can give a lot more exposure to the fruit hanging in the middle of the canopy. So you can have a canopy up to 2 meters high, let's say 6 feet high, going both directions, so the ground and up sort of head height, with the grapes hanging in the middle. And the reason that works is that there's some work done by Steve Price at Oregon University on importance of a sunblock compound called quercetin. Quercetin is a building block, compound for anthocyanin pigments, the colors, flavonoids, you know, the flavors, and the tannins, phenolics, and so it all relates to sunlight. So interestingly, that quercetin is sort of like a UV sunblock for fruit. So it occurs in lots of other fruits as well, particularly dark colored fruits. So that quercetin is like us putting sunblock on our skins. And so there's a really nice link there, because that sunlight, that extra UV sunlight, gives you, it's like a volume control. It actually increases the aroma compounds, increases the flavor, the texture, the structure of the wine, as well as the mature tannins on the finish. So the thing we found at Mount Edelson when we first put in 10 rows of Scott Henry as a trial back in 1989, it also increased the pepperiness of the Shiraz. And that's something we didn't expect. And that's something we haven't really properly been able to explain.
So let's talk about one of your single vineyards you have near a church, which would be translated, the name of the church, as Hill of Grace, where your forefather used to play the organ. You have a vineyard called Hill of Grace.
Right.
And that vineyard has a few different grape varieties planted in it.
Mm.
There's an original block of vines from 1860s, and then there's grape varieties like Riesling, Semillon, and even Mataro, I didn't know. And Peru has more recently gone through and looked at the old original block of Shiraz vines from the 1860s, the pre-phylloxera vines that survived the root louse problem that affected most of Europe, and she has been propagating those.
That's right.
So put me in a place and tell me what she's been up to.
Right. I guess what happened was, when we got back from Germany and we were looking at the vineyards, we realized that there was a proportion of the vines in these old, really old vineyards like Maddles and Hill of Grace that were suffering from what's known as dead arm disease. So it's a Utica lata species that effectively, it's ubiquitous, but if it infects the vines, grows into the vines, and then it's a toxin from this fungus that causes the weakening of the arms, the shoots of the vine, and eventually kills the vine. And it might take 6-10 years or whatever. And the control mechanism for that's very difficult. It's really, you have to prune away until you get rid of this fungus. Or you work from a process of improving your hygiene in the vineyard by painting all of your pruning cuts, only making small pruning cuts, only 1-year-old wood, rather than pruning off, you know, old arms and things like that. And so we did that straight away. You know, we banned saws and big snips and went back to just making small cuts and pruning when it was dry rather than when it was raining, because that helps to increase it. It's all to do with the surface tension of the xylem tissue, the water conducting tissue in the plant. So we did that, but also we recognized that there were going to be vines there that could be the best vines in that vineyard that were going to get the disease and die, and we would lose that genetic material. And knowing that these were some of the oldest vines in the world, on their own roots, dry grown, really a museum of varieties out of Europe, particularly the Shiraz and the Hill of Grace, we decided that we had to do a program of vine selection, sort of mass selection in the vineyard. So Prue was the right person to do it, you know, with her botanical background and her studies in Geisenheim. So she selected using the Geisenheim mass selection principles involved. And my uncle was still alive and running the vineyard at the time, Uncle Lewis. And he did his own selection as well, which was really fascinating to have. You know, these two different backgrounds selecting the vines. He knew them by name. You know, he had his favourite vines, and so he selected the ones that he thought were the best. She selected hers. And we put them both into a nursery vineyard alongside, we call Post Office Block 3. And that gave us then a collection of the best genetic material out of that vineyard. And it was done over, you know, really over about 2 years as a primary selection. And we also had a German girl come and live with us for nearly a year, Uschi. So one of them was called Uschi Selection. And that was because Prue was having babies at the time and, you know, she couldn't be there all the time doing all the tagging and marking and what have you. But she looked at the time of bud burst, the number of flowering bunches, the time of flowering, the number of, you know, sort of bunches per shoot, the time of ripening, you know, the level of virus in the grapes. So you could test all that. And then picking time, we'd looked at even analyses of the fruit and what have you. So there was an enormous amount of work to do. And then we did, from that nursery, then we did a reselection program so we could actually select down to a tighter group of best individuals. And the reason for that is that if you just select from the vineyard, there could be other factors playing a role, like soil type changes or whatever. And so we had to plant on a more neutral site and then plant in 5-vine replicates so that we could even up all those sort of vagaries of nature and come up with a more honest selection. And in fact, with Mount Edelson, we did the same thing at Mount Edelson. We did actually find a vine we called the super vine, and once we planted it in the nursery, it didn't behave like that anymore. So, you know, it was obviously sitting on something really sweet in the ground and it just loved it and it just, you know, performed amazingly. And a lot of the performance is to do with maturity figures in terms of balance. So at a certain ripeness, if you have a higher acidity and a lower pH, that's more valuable as a grape than one that has a very high pH and low acid, where you have to adjust, which you don't really want to do as a winemaker. So having Prue as a, if you like, a partner running vineyards and running vineyards with a focus of the environment, of the ecology, is really a fantastic thing for a Henschke and fantastic thing for me, because it just gave us that extra edge, I think, in terms of vine health, vine quality. And we're looking long term. You know, this is, we're fifth generation now. Our son's sixth generation. He's starting to work with us. And we want to see Henschke go for, you know, another six generations. And so by passing the vineyards on to the next generation in better condition than we inherited them from our ancestors, that's the only thing we can do. It's the best thing we can do for them. So that's what it's about.
And your grandfather used to make dry red wine and drink that, but he used to sell fortified wines at Henschke. And what was the change in the production from your grandfather to now? And how would you sort of summarize the numerous different wines that you make? Because there are quite a few in both colors and from different places.
Yeah. I think you have to sort of look back historically to answer that. And if you think of where they came from in sort of more northern Europe, they were growing Riesling. You think of how Riesling ripens in a cold climate, they would have struggled to get it ripe. You know, if they got it up to 10% alcohol, that was a really good year. And so the natural preservative in the wine was the acidity. So when it fermented down, you know, probably struggled to ferment. They would have had to keep it near a copper somewhere to keep it warm to ferment it through. It would have had probably some residual sugar. It wouldn't have fermented to dryness and high acidity. So that was sort of the balance of the wine, which is the basis of German wines, that sort of sweeter, higher acid and lower alcohol. And when you brought varieties to Australia, we had a warmer climate in South Australia, they ripened up easily. So you ended up with potential higher alcohol, naturally, you know, sort of 10, 11, 12%, whatever. Lower acidity. When the juice was fermented, it fermented easily because it was warmer climate and fermented to dryness. So the balance was higher alcohol, lower acid, and dry wine, no sugar. And so that became the formula. And whether it's red wine or sweet wine, it sort of follows the same thing. So our wines are really well suited as table wines for food. And you can imagine when the settlers first arrived, they were growing their grapes, making these wines, that the climate dictated the style of wine they were making. That was climate driven. And it matched their style of food, because from Silesian Germany, they were making, you know, sort of smoked meats and Zau gherkins, you know, pickled gherkins, dill cucumbers, different hand käse, you know, hand squash cheeses, you know, it's from the quark sort of style, different breads, and, you know, there's a, you know, we called them smoked the smoked sausages, we call them wurst, which is like wurst, but you know, the Silesian dialect. And so all these beautiful wurst were made and sold and eaten and stuff. And it just went beautifully with those dry wines. So you can understand why generation after generation, the families drank the wines that suited their sort of lifestyle. But the wines they were selling suited the market they were selling to. And the market changed dramatically towards the turn of the century because there was more wine being exported to the UK. And the table wines weren't stable enough in barrel, you know, hogshead shipped across the equator to the UK. These table wines oxidised and, you know, lost their freshness. And often the sailors would probably help themselves anyway and, you know, do more damage. So by fortifying the wines, by adding spirit to these fermenting wines and making sweet alcoholic sherries and inverted commas and ports and those sorts of things, they became a huge market for the UK particularly, you know, the fatherland for the English settlers. And my grandfather, you know, like everybody else, was making these fortified wines to suit that export market. He wasn't selling them there directly, but through other people. And so, you know, there was that diversity of wine styles and wine fashions. And sure, we're making these hocks, you know, sort of named after Hochheim in Germany, and clarets named after, you know, part of France or whatever, but they were made from Shiraz and Riesling and what have you. And it wasn't really until a new wine and food culture happened in Australia, and that was after the Second World War, when a lot of the Southern Europeans settled, a lot of Greeks and Italians settled in Australia, that we had an introduction of a different food style and the demand for wine to drink with that food style. So with this, you know, the pastas and all those sorts of things, you know, the Italians families wanted to have red wine on the table to drink with that. And a great example is Beppi's restaurant in Sydney. Beppi Palese has celebrated 50 years of his restaurant. He still has empty bottles of my father's 50s wines in his, you know, in his cellar, that he'd, you know, drunk from those really early days. And it's pretty amazing to celebrate, you know, those a whole 50 years of a wine being sold in one restaurant just in Sydney, and, you know, what a great celebration that is for the culture and the success of it. So that wine and food culture really changed the landscape in Australia, because effectively Australia, most of Australia is settled by the English, and it was meat and three veg, you know, pretty boring food, and they, you know, they weren't so much wine drinkers. If they drank wine, I think the high society of English would have drunk imported wines rather than Australian wines. So yeah, my father was one of the first, Cyril Henschke was one of the early, I guess the early pioneers of single vineyard table wines. And our Riesling, which is now started in the early 50s, Mount Edelson 1952, Hiller Grace in 1958. And so these, Mount Edelson particularly, as far as we know, is the oldest single vineyard wine made in Australia, as a consecutively made. And so now we've made 60 consecutive vintages of it. So that really, you know, sets a lovely story about the history of Australian wine, because most people think Australia's a new world. It happened in the last 10 minutes. And here we are with, you know, with 500 million year old soils, with vines that are 150 years old, a sixth generation family, making wines from one particular vineyard for 60 years. So, you know, there is a lot of history in Australia and a lot of character.
And at one point you did a 50-year tasting of your family's wines, and you sort of remarked, well, it seems like I'm closer to the wines that are further away from me, just in terms of taste, but maybe in what I'm doing. And what did you mean by that in terms of technique?
Yeah, we opened up 50 vintages of Hiller Grace early in the year and had a number of wine writers, including a number from around the world, who came along for the tasting. And it was a very special tasting because some of the vintages we only had one bottle of. But the oldest wine, the 1958 Hiller Grace, we tasted right through. And when I got to the 2008, I realised we had bookends. You know, they were so similar in style. The 58 was It's a lovely ripeness about it, still beautiful fruit, even though it'd been sitting under this cork for 50 years. And showed a style of wine more like what we're making today, because through the 70s and 80s, the styles change, fashions change. So when you line them up, those 50 vintages, you do actually see the changes in fashion, the changes in lifestyle, the changes in all sorts of cultural things that reflect in these 50 different wines. And it made me think about what happened before they started making the 58 Hiller Grace and the 52 Mount Edelston. And they really came off of an era of fortified winemaking. And if you think about how you make fortifieds, you need to add alcohol. You need to buy the alcohol. That costs money. So if you can get the grapes as ripe as possible before you add the alcohol, you have to spend less money on the alcohol. And that's really what they were used to doing, picking ripe, then fortifying and selling it that way. So when they started making the table wines, they were actually used to picking the fruit mature, and they had these lovely sort of structural, intense wines that have lasted in the bottle for 50 years. You wouldn't have believed it, would you?
So what other wines do you make? You mentioned the Hill of Grace, the Julius Riesling, the Mount Edelstone. What else is out there?
Yeah, it's interesting. The major red grape varieties in South Australia were Shiraz, Grenache and Mataro, often called Mourvèdre. Shiraz came from the Hermitage region, so it was a mispronunciation or misspelling of Syrah, and so it's really become Australia's variety because nobody else makes Shiraz like Australia does. The Grenache and Mourvèdre probably came from Spain to Australia, so they would have been Garnacha and Mataro. And they've settled in well, and I think in the last couple of decades, Grenache and Mataro are starting to come back as being important varieties as well to make red wine from. And so they're the early varieties, and the early white varieties were Riesling and curiously Semillon, and I don't know why this Bordeaux variety Semillon came to Australia so early, but there are 100-year-old vines of Semillon around the place. But a lot of other grape varieties like the Muscat varieties, Muscat à Petit Grand Blanc, from Frontignan sort of area, and a lot of Spanish varieties, Pedro Ximénez and all those sorts of things. So we had a whole motley bunch of white grape varieties, probably the more traditional varieties that came. But Riesling obviously came across because of the German settlement of South Australia, and it sort of fitted the picture quite well. And it suited us, and it suited the high country. So that mountain range that I mentioned earlier that runs north-south, which is a barrier to the weather that comes from the prevailing winds from the southwest, has within it, down the bottom end at the Adelaide Hills, if you go up another sort of 50 kilometres or so, you get into Eden Valley. If you go up another 100 kilometres or so further north, you get to Clare Valley. So those three regions are all in the same mountain range, and they're all above 400 metres in altitude. And they all get what we call a more continental climate, because once you're up in the higher in altitude, you tend to get colder nights during the summertime with the warm days. So you get that continentality, which holds the acidity high and the purity of the fruit. But since then, we've also planted lots of other varieties. My father was interested in trialing different varieties, so he planted a bunch of different things, including Cabernet Sauvignon, and then Prue and I have added to Chardonnay and Sauvignon Blanc and Merlot and Cabernet Franc and things like that as well. So there's a sort of nice diversity of varieties that make up our portfolio, and people sometimes rather concerned that we're making so many wines. But I look at it this way. Instead of just having one wine and getting bored to tears with making that one wine, by having all these other varieties, you've actually got different challenges, new challenges that keeps your mind active in terms of research and development, and you're all the time trying to look at something different. And these are all made in small lots, so we can manage it easily, whether it's one big lot or whether it's lots of small lots, we can do the same thing. So it's for us, it's about stimulation of ideas and you know, in improving what we're doing all the time. Just, you know, our philosophy is to be better rather than bigger. So we're, you know, all the time looking at making it better in the vineyards and better out in the winery.
And you, in some bottlings, blend Shiraz with Cabernet Sauvignon, which isn't everybody who does that. What led you to that decision and why?
Right. That's actually a very old Australian technique. And it came about because Cabernet was very rare in those early days. So by blending Cabernet with a little bit of Shiraz, they could call it, you know, Shiraz Cabernet, or some people called it Cabernet Shiraz. And it gave them that Cabernet word on the label that was a trendy new variety. But
hard to imagine now.
Yeah,
that exactly. It would be a trend. You know, I mean, just from this market.
True, but interestingly, it does something else. And when we blended some Cabernet into our Cainton red wine, the Cainton Euphonium, in the old days, that was actually originally my father's dry red wine back in the 50s. It was just from, you know, different growers and things until we planted some more Shiraz at Eden Valley. And then in the 80s, after it changed its name a few times and ended up being called Cainton Estate, Prue and I were looking at trying to make this wine more fruit friendly and looking at more of a savoury style of Shiraz. And we blended some Cabernet in and we realised that the Cabernet actually gives a lovely savouriness to the wine. It actually adds in those fine grain tannins. It gives it a different texture, brings in some of the cassis fruits of the Cabernet, some violety sort of aromas, and it changes the style and actually makes it not a better wine, but it makes it a different, you know, really lovely food wine. And it sort of fits that pattern of, you know, wine and food, but it also just happens to fit that pattern of that sort of what became common in Australia of adding Cabernet to some Shiraz to, you know, to make, sell it better. Because over time, Shiraz became the workhorse variety and Cabernet Sauvignon became the exclusive variety, you know, the variety that everybody wanted to buy. So we had, when I was a young guy back in the 80s and after my father had passed away and I was making these wines, and I had a journalist who came to the winery one day, and he wanted to taste some of the wines that I'd made, and so we had a barrel tasting, and eventually we got around to a sample of the 1980 Hill of Grace. And he said to me, "Stephen, this is the most beautiful Cabernet I've ever seen." I didn't have the heart to tell him it was Shiraz.
I've definitely made that mistake before myself.
and it was, you know, because people expected a great wine to be made from Cabernet, not from Shiraz. That funny time of market.
Something else that may have been a funny time for you was finding a good oak source. How did you work with that challenge to develop something to age your wines in?
Yeah, my father used more larger format oak, which was more common back in his time. And as we introduced more and more smaller oak, what happened was that particularly American oak, because American oak was really popular in Australia back in that time. And I don't really know why. I actually need to ask a question myself sometime about that to try to get a proper answer. But it's either to do with the cost or just convenience, practicality, whatever. But you look at a lot of those Australian dry reds wines from the 50s and 60s, and they were predominantly American oak.
Penfolds, I think, early on. Yeah.
They're a good example. But what concerned me about the oak was that it seemed to me too young and too severe. There were sort of shellacky flavours. It wasn't properly seasoned. You could see the ends of the barrels warp. So I went and talked to our cooper, Peter John, who had taken over from his father, Warren, who'd taken over from his grandfather, AP. And my grandfather used to buy barrels from his grandfather. My father bought barrels from his father. So, you know, we had this close connection. And Peter and I sat down together and made a 10-year plan for oak to get better quality oak. And that was really to bring in better seasoned oak, so seasoned longer under snow in the Appalachian Mountains over near Pittsburgh, and to season longer in the Barossa. So at Peter's yard, and we stacked up the oak, the staves, timbers. And he would watch it for me until he believed it was ready. So we would, you know, we'd bring in container loads and season it for 3 years, 4 years, 5 years to get the best quality oak. And we had the oldest season oak in the Barossa sitting in Peter's yard to, you know, get the most mature flavours. And we're looking for more northern oak, so we're trying to get the finer grained oak as well. And it was a success because it gave us oak that was much more subtle. It, you know, it didn't look like French oak, but it was more subtle. It had vanilla flavours, but it was more sort of subtle spices. Didn't have those bourbony characters that you quite often get when you put white wine into American oak. And it didn't have any of those astringent characters. And one thing it did give, it gave us sweetness on the palate. So when you tasted, say, Hill of Grace in different oak types from different forests in France and from America, the American oak had that sweetness of fruit and sweetness on the palate that you didn't see in the others. The French oaks tend to dry the wine more. And it was really amazing. So as a component in the blend, it was good. It's a bit like cooking, you know, it's a bit like looking at the seasonings that work together well without dominating the food. This is all about not dominating wine, but building the structure in the wine.
You and Prue, somewhat unique. It's not every couple that I know where one does viticulture and the other does the winemaking. A lot of times it's two brothers who do that.
That's
or
right.
Maybe the wife does sales or marketing or sees to the office. Here you have someone who's highly accomplished on her own merits, over her own career working in the vines, and she's also your wife. Do you ever disagree? Does she ever, you know, want to plant more Cabernet than you want to vinify, and then you guys fight and she doesn't pass you the potatoes at the dinner table? Or, you know, how do you work out your own conversations about the winery?
I'm very lucky. She's an absolute sweetheart. She always says, "Yes, darling, you're perfectly right." No, it doesn't happen that way.
Yeah, right, right. Now that she doesn't happen to be here and can't slap you,
yeah, can't defend herself. Well, as it turns out, sometimes we do have little disagreements and things. But I think, you know, over a period of time, you live and you live it and you breathe it, you know, and you have pillow talk about all sorts of subjects. And if it's work, that's bad luck. But, you know, sometimes it can be. And it's about discussing it through. And I think, you know, both having known each other for so long from university times, we understand each other well, and we both have the same, I think we both have the same drive for what we're doing. She has a fantastic palate, and so I trust her palate. And it's good because, or it's really important because that connection between the two, I mean, what really fundamentally the quality of the wine in the bottle of Henschke is about what comes from the vineyard. I have very little to do with it. I'm just a caretaker to make sure it goes through its fermentation and its oak aging and it ends up in the bottle looking beautiful. And quite often at vintage time, she'll say to me, "Now, don't muck it up." So, you know, I think I am very lucky because we've turned out to be the perfect partnership in terms of her environmental beliefs, but also her passion for getting, you know, the soil health there, the vine health there. So we can practice still dry grown viticulture and have good, healthy vines that will keep living longer. Because, you know, it looks like as global warming comes along, we're going to get drier. And so drought proofing is very important for us.
Have you found tasteable results with the biodynamic conversion? At the end of the day, can you say, "Boy, these are different than what we used to make"?
I don't think it's as conclusive as that. I'd love to say yes, but I think what drives the vintage variation more is the climate. But what I do believe is happening is that because we've got much healthier soils now, the vines are coping a lot better, and so they're managing the stresses of dry seasons and wet seasons better. And so as you're getting better quality fruit and probably, you know, less diseased fruit as well, but certainly better quality fruit, and I think that better quality fruit is translating into better wines. But I can't categorically say that because we don't have the measurables to put one style alongside the other. You know, we've sort of gone wholesale towards biodynamic because we know it's the right thing to do. And even if it was the wrong thing to do, it's not doing the vineyard any harm. Even if it's just a religion, it's not doing the vineyard any harm because it's helping, you know, the health of the vineyard. But we know it's more than that. You know, we know it's to do with microbiology. You know, it's to do with that subtle health in the vineyard where the bugs, you know, do something positive in terms of soil health.
And what about those screw caps?
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people wouldn't bottle their top reds under screw caps, the ones that are meant to age for a long time. You do? Why the choice? What does it mean for you?
I think as a winemaker, I was lucky. Having studied in Germany, all the wines made at Geisenheim, the research wines, all bottled under screw cap. That's back in the mid-70s. And the reason they did that was because by bottling under cork, it made all those experiments useless, because the corks were just too variable. So bottling under screw cap, you got consistency, and you knew that you could see the differences between the different clones, the different trials, different vintages and what have you. So Becker really imparted that well into us. There were also a few wineries back in the 70s, and one of them was Yolumba, who were doing trials with screw caps. And now when you do a museum tasting of those old Yolumba Puseys and cart doors, you're stunned at how glorious those wines look under screw cap and how horrible those wines look under cork. But, you know, back when we started doing it back in the, the mid-90s, you know, we'd left it a long time, and year after year bottling the Riesling under a cork. And then you look at it and you just see the wine being destroyed by this woody flavour of the cork, and often, you know, the TCA and all those sort of issues, and then the crumbling and random oxidation, all those sort of problems. And we were just hanging out for something better to come along. And it ultimately did. You know, we started bottling Riesling under the old-fashioned screw cap, and then the new Stilven, the BVS finished Stilven, came out with the 2000 vintage. And that was really the answer to our prayers, because it gave us a bottle that you could fill to the proper or correct height and to allow a 30 millimeter vacuity with the screw cap on top. And so you didn't get any oxidation under the screw cap. And it's kept those wines in beautiful, pristine condition over years. So we can go back now to 1996 with the Rieslings that we started bottling under the screw cap. And I actually did a trial at the same time with red wine under screw cap from 95 with our Caton. And I've been amazed at how well those wines have aged. And one example, somebody made a comment when we bottled a Henry VII Shiraz Grenache Viognier. Actually, Shiraz and Viognier co-fermented, then some Grenache blended in. We bottled that with 20% screw cap and 80% cork, because I didn't really know how it was going to go in the marketplace. And I sent samples out to all the journalists. And one journalist very acutely pointed out to me the fact that under the screw cap he could see Shiraz Grenache Viognier, but under the cork he could only see red wine. And I thought it was a beautiful summary of what we were trying to achieve. We were trying to achieve something that showed, you know, the flavours of the varieties in there that would age over time. There's been a lot of work done on the influence of screw cap, particularly by the Australian Wine Research Institute, and it's easy to look up on their website and look at all that. But red wine and white wine do both age, but they age more slowly, and they age more like they're in a large format bottle. So if you were going to open up a Magnum or a Double Magnum or an Imperial or something or other, that's really how the red wine and the even white wine and the screw cap ages. So it keeps the fruit, but also allows secondary aging characters to develop as well. And the fear that most people have got that screw cap becomes reductive, you know, wine becomes reductive under screw cap, we haven't seen. And in fact, another Australian journalist, James Halliday, and I were involved in the Great Australian Shiraz Challenge tastings a number of years, or judgings. And we got to a stage where one year we were seeing more sulphide, you know, a lot of reds now under screw cap. But we're seeing just this slightly more red wine showing sulphide than others in the tasting. And I said to James, because somebody said, well, maybe it's because of screw cap. And I said to James, why don't we keep a record of what wines are showing sulphide and assess whether they're under screw cap or under cork. So Viv, the steward, kept all the records of when we picked up sulfide, and afterwards we analysed the results, and it was 50-50, which meant the sulfide came from the winemaking and not from the closure. So that was quite enlightening, and it validated, you know, a lot of our feeling as winemakers. So screw cap is probably best described as being like the best possible cork. You know, it seals the bottle like a cork is supposed to do. It's supposed to keep the wine and seal it perfectly. But sadly, most corks don't achieve that. So, you know, as a winemaker, I'm from the direction of zero cork taint policy. You know, we should ban, you know, cork taint out of the wine industry. But also, I've got a dilemma because I'm a traditional winemaker. I've got, you know, five generations of winemaking. We still use traditional techniques of making our wine and open submerged cap concrete fermenters. We use, you know, oak barrels and all those sorts of things. So, you know, you could quite fairly say to me, well, you know, why don't you then use corks? But I think you get to a point where you can't sleep at night as a winemaker, knowing, particularly when I'm selling a wine like Hill of Grace, it's $500, $600 a bottle, knowingly selling it, knowing that up to 10% of that wine can be faulty. And that's what really drove me to the point of saying, well, I've got to find a better closure than cork, because I've got these people ringing me up in the middle of the night from America and from England saying, oh, my night's just been ruined. I opened up a Hill of Grace and it's corked and what have you, and crying over the phone, and, you know, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. There was a reason, you know, and that reason is to give the consumer better wine. But since then, another closure has come along, which is the glass cork. And we were in Germany at the Stuttgart Interviertes back in 2004 when it was launched. We saw this, it looked like a diamond on the top of the bottle. And I dug Pruner ribs and said, you know, we're going to put Hill of Grace under this. Doesn't this look beautiful? So we got the first bottles out to Australia and the closures, and set up a trial. Decided to use a third party, the Australian Wine Research Institute, to do the due diligence on that closure so that we could determine whether that was going to be a long-term viable closure for our top quality wines. And we have now over 5 years of data, and we can predict, if you like, a graph of how that wine's going to age out over 20 years, and it looks fantastic. It's very much like screw cap. It's very much like a large format bottle in the way it behaves, and that's because, you know, the surface area of the closures are the same, and it's a gorgeous looking closure, and it suits those markets where they don't understand screw cap, and certainly the Southeast Asian markets, some parts of Europe and what have you, and even some parts of America, where people don't understand screw caps, they see it but they think it's cheap and nasty. They don't realise it's actually a better closure. That's where that glass cork is great, because it still has that traditional feel, and it's the same price as an expensive cork. So it's, and 100% reliable. So why wouldn't you use it? So yeah, they're the sorts of, I think sometimes, you know, innovations are important, even in traditional winemaking.
And what about the next generation? Your son has been doing some stages at different wineries around the world. What's he like, and what's he been up to?
He's a really great guy. He's studied winemaking at Adelaide University. He's very keen to continue on the family business. And we don't know how many that we've got. Three children, a daughter and another son, Andreas. So Johan, Justine and Andreas are the three kids. We don't know whether they're all going to come into it or not, but Johan certainly wants to carry it on. He's just completed a two-year international master's in oenology and viticulture based in Montpellier, and has come back and has been working with us since January this year. So the sixth generation is there and quite happy to help for the time being his mother and his father, which is pretty, sort of brings tears to your eyes knowing that you've got another generation there wanting to continue it on. And it's rather nice being able to say, you know, one of your workmen comes to work in the morning and says, "Good day, Dad." It's sort of a rather nice thing for a father.
When he's on time, I guess.
Yeah,
when he's on time. The other time trying to get over.
Where the hell are you?
Yeah.
But he's working from the direction of his mother's field, so he's working from the vineyards at the moment. So he's been helping Peru in the viticulture side, the viticulture research side, working at Lenswood, which is really our toughest, challenging vineyard because of the higher altitude, the colder climate, the wetter seasons, and the high potential disease. And so it's a great place to start and for him to look at where the best components of our fruit are so we can evaluate that fruit more and more over time. But ultimately he'll come back into taking over from us, and us or me, or probably I'll go out fishing and Prue will stay on helping in the vineyards and Johan will take over the winemaking.
Again, Prue not here to slap you. Yeah. But has the market received your wines differently over your tenure?
That's interesting. I think there's always there's a generational change, and I think there's a period where people seem to have a concern that the wines aren't the same as they used to be, or that the new generation is going to change it, and I think that's what happened when I took over from my father. I kept on getting these comments from some of his old cronies who used to buy his wine, or Stephen, you'll never make wines as good as your father did. And
hope you took those guys off the distribution list. Jesus Christ, not very nice.
But you have to take those things on the chin, and it, if anything, it gives you that that extra spurt to do a better job than you would have done. And so Prue and I, when we first took over and carried on the business, we made our sort of 10-year plan of where we wanted to be, and certainly technology has changed dramatically. I think that's the biggest thing. Our generation was a technology generation. Well, not quite what your technology is, in terms of computer technology, but it certainly was in terms of winemaking. And we could do, instead of one analysis, we could do a dozen different analyses on the grapes and on the wine to make sure that the wine was better quality when it got to the bottle. But it's every generation has a different way of looking at things, and fashions change. So, most people would have thought that Hensky would have driven the Shiraz style quite differently to where we were, and maybe not introduce so many different grape varieties and what have you. But, like I said earlier, it's about learning, and it's about stimulation. I think it's nice to look back, particularly when we did that 50-year tasting. It's nice to look back through the vintages that we made and the vintages that my father made. And I think what really shows up that really amazed me the most was that in those very good vintages, and those very good vintages were vintages like 59 and 62 and 72 and 78 and 86 and 90 and what have you, those vintages that were really great vintages, doesn't matter how rustic the winemaking was, they stood out as being great wines. And I think that's really what it's all about. That was a vineyard talking. And even if my father didn't have the technology and the science behind him, in those great vintages, he still made great wines. And now that we've got the technologies and science there, I'm hoping that I can still say that in the great vintages we're making great wines as well, and in between time we're possibly making better wines, and he had the opportunity to because we've got that technology to support us.
Stephen Hensky, he's looking back and forward at Hensky Family Winery in Australia. Thank you, sir.
Pleasure.
The big news for the podcast in 2014, retail partnership, my friend. The wines we care about from the folks who are on the show, offered to you by the excellent team at Vine Wine. Go to vine-wine.com for more information about what we're up to and to find the wines. That's vine-wine.com. Check it out. Cheers.
Hey, this is Michael Madrigal from Barbalude and Balude Sud. In case you haven't heard of 750, you should know about it. It's a tool for wine buyers, for wine directors, for sommeliers, to find wines, to find the prices, to find the distributors, to do all of those things that you need to do in your daily job to do work on your wine list. And I am a big fan of it. And if you don't know it, you should do your homework and find out.
Folks, I'm happy to report that the Riesling FIA will soon be returning to New York from February 20th through February 22nd. This is the second time around that Steven Bitterhoff has organized an amazing celebration of German Riesling. And let me tell you, last year was freaking sensational. Awesome. Well done and a lot of fun. This year, the main event, the big dinner, is already sold out. But you can email info@rieslingfeer.com to get on the waiting list, which is pretty much the only way to buy tickets anymore, or to find out about the special Riesling Fear seminars and smaller dinners that will also be coming up. I highly recommend contacting Steven. It's info@rieslingfeer, so I-N-F-O, at Riesling, F-E-I-E-R, rieslingfeer.com. Send him an email, find out the details, and keep an eye out for the upcoming Riesling Crawl on February 22nd, which will feature several top New York German-centric retailers for some really fabulous tastings. Get there, drink Riesling, experience the Riesling Fear. You won't be disappointed. Delish.
And that's our episode of I'll Drink to That. We release a new show each Tuesday and every other Friday. You can find the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or stream it off our own dedicated website, alldrinktothatpod.com. No apostrophe. Thanks for listening, and if you like what you hear, leave us a comment or shoot us a tweet.